Fifth case for argument this morning is Mobley against Allstate Insurance.
Hey, please, the court. My name is Kevin Betts. I'm here.
Wait.
I apologize.
We always wait for people to be able to find a seat. Mr. Betts.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it please the court, my name is Kevin Betts. I'm here representing Ms. Kathy Mobley, who for 14 years was a stellar employee of Allstate Insurance. She either met or exceeded expectations for 14 years. I believe there are two points that show that summary judgment was wrongly entered in this case. Both of these points begin with the undisputed fact that Ms. Kathy Mobley was disabled, undisputed disabled under the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and she was entitled, it is undisputed, to a reasonable accommodation under the ADA.
There is actually some talk in the briefs, this may count as a dispute, about whether it was understood from the very outset that this really was an ADA-type disability, by which I mean a permanent one, as opposed to some temporary condition that once she got over it, she wouldn't need the private room, she wouldn't need the accommodations that were being given to her.
There's nowhere in the record is there any point that it was called temporary by either counsel or the employer at any point. That was put in the summary judgment decision by the U.S. District Court in the Southern District of Indiana, but there is just no point in the record that supports that. 505 to 506 points to the doctors, which is undisputed medical evidence, saying it's chronic, progressive, lifelong disease, the essential tremor, and nocturnal myoclonus. Now, there are periods, like with any disease, that it would improve and it would get worse, but it is definitely not a temporary disease. It is a disease, these diseases, that will last a lifetime.
So the district court just made a mistake by drawing that inference from the record?
Absolutely. There is nothing even to infer it. I'm trying to be sort of absolute here, but it is that absolute. There is nothing in the record to support that it was a temporary disease of any kind. The undisputed medical evidence shows that it was progressive, lifelong, and there is no medical evidence to dispute that whatsoever.
What are we to do, though, with the fact at the end this company was dealing with a reduction in force situation, and those are situations in which they need to make relative judgments about employees, and Ms. Mobley's performance, even with the accommodation, had never fully recovered, I guess. She'd squeaked back up to meets expectations, and then she'd slip below. And so where do we find some kind of illegal action on the part of the company?
Well, first of all, this is an indirect evidence case. It's the mosaic of facts, as most of these civil rights cases are under the ADA. And jurors, being experts at employment and being experts at being employees, are the best ones to determine these facts and determine whether discrimination occurred and whether it was intentional violation of the ADA. You can also look to the record here where Alex Balasukas, the not direct supervisor but supervisor above Ms. Mobley's supervisor, revoked in January, at the end of January of 2003, when this accommodation, very simple accommodation, was working. Her job performance was improving, and it was revoked. This accommodation, which was enormously simple, enormously reasonable, undisputedly reasonable, was revoked without any explanation to this day. And then the HR director had to command Ms. Balasukas, it's in the record in 517 of the appendix, had to command Ms. Balasukas to return her. Begrudgingly, she did, but then did it in a stop-start type of way. The record is replete with, okay, I'll give you this accommodation, and then Ms. Balasukas revokes it and talks about the fact that we're all going to be performing our duties under the same and equal methods, which is not in the spirit of the ADA. So Ms. Balasukas gives testimony, and her actions show she does not want to comply with the ADA. She has to be commanded to do so. When Ms. Balasukas then puts her back in the room that is a very simple accommodation, she does so with restrictions that deny her the ability to perform. As well, The performance is a phony baloney reduction in force. It is the modern way to sweep discrimination under the rug is to call it a reduction in force.
That we have evidence that suggests that the whole reduction in force. As I see it, your theories intertwine, that if she'd gotten the correct accommodation all along, her performance level would have stabilized and she wouldn't have been in that group in the records that were pulled reflecting the end of August performance, and so whoever the 32 people might have been, she would not have been among them. In a nutshell, is that your theory?
Half true. As to the stop-start of the accommodation, true. False as to the reduction in force. This was not a reduction in force. It was called a reduction in force, but when you analyze it, the only thing that makes a reduction in force is there an objective criteria? When you sit at the deposition with the HR director and you say, what was the objective criteria for this objective reduction
in force? I don't understand that at all. I mean, if they really did delete 32 employees, even if they did it by flipping coins, I mean, it would be a reduction in force.
That would be a great objective criteria. We flipped coins. I'd say, okay, well, that seems sort of silly, but you can run your business the way you want to. That's not what they told us here. They told us here that the reduction in force was based on if you were on the requires improvement.
Right.
As it turns out, the facts show otherwise. People
right.
who were on the requires improvement were not terminated, and people who were off of it were fired.
No, so and I understand your theory there is that there are stated explanation
it's
isn't
false.
The real explanation, that's something else. But whatever it is, it's not that.
Hey, absolutely. It's false, it's pretext, and this should be going to a jury. I will have the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Betts. Mr. McLaughlin.
May it please the Court to go directly to Judge Wood's question about whether this is temporary and Judge Barker's reference to it as being temporary. Counsel's reference, there was absolutely nothing in the record to support that, is unfortunate. At the record page, the appendix 486, as of October 7th of 2002, Dr. Gure is the only medical professional who's offered any opinions in this case, stated, and I quote, "Currently we are trying her on different medications to see what would benefit her the most. I feel that she should improve with time and her work should also improve with time."
But I'm not sure. I mean, I thought that the district court, to put it in summary judgment lingo, was not drawing the inferences in the manner most favorable to the opponent of the motion. I didn't see much evidence at all in all of those appendices, really maybe nothing but what you've just said. But even people with chronic conditions can improve somewhat and nonetheless still be disabled.
Correct.
People can learn to read Braille better. You know, they're still blind, but they're better at reading Braille or what have you.
We agree. And part of this is to remember that, in fact, the judge did not hinge her decision on that fact. That was a reference she made, which was explaining why the accommodations were undertaken in October.
But the troublesome thing to me about what appears to be Ms. Baltsukas's attitude is she seems to think that no accommodations is the only way to run the business, because that's the only way you can have everybody working on the same under the same conditions. That this strikes me as fundamentally inconsistent with the ADA.
And what is important to note, Your Honor, is it was not Ms. Baltsukas's decision. Ultimately, there was an interactive process based on the information they had at the time, which was both Dr. Gure and the plaintiff herself saying, "I'm going to get better." They did, in fact, put her in the huddle room, a private office.
Well, eventually, but not until after she'd been out of it for a while and the improvement that she's achieving has slipped away from her again. Then they put her back in, and she starts doing better. And then there's this weird, you can't work past 5:30. Business, even though it's cost neutral to the employer.
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. She is put in that huddle room at her request in late November, early December.
Right, and then she's out again in January.
No, she was, based on her January performance, she was not removed from the huddle room until March. In that same month, Ms. Baltsukas said, and the record at least on Baltsukas' affidavit is, we had told her all along, you can get in there till you get up to speed. Once you're up to speed, you come out. And she did. In that same month, in March, they said, we're going to send you back, but we will
let you start later than others, an additional accommodation. We will remove bodily injury, put you on bodily injury files,
but that,
another
that
accommodation.
That struck me as pretextual as well, because if you look at all of the workloads, those shifting around of files and claims winds up simply equalizing her a little bit with the others. I mean, she does have more work.
Your Honor, she was a senior employee. The suggestion that it's not an accommodation unless we lessen her burden below others is nowhere in the law.
I'm not saying you had to go below, but I'm saying I don't see why it's an accommodation if you just, to a degree, treat her the way you treat other people.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Her accommodation was, if I'm requiring her to do X plus, and I reduce the amount of work she needs to do to X, I have offered her an accommodation. I'm not saying that's the ultimate accommodation, but it was an accommodation. Here, the process that I want to be clear on is we offer the reasonable accommodation. Everyone agrees putting her in the huddle room is a reasonable accommodation that worked. It is rare that we get an ADA case where both sides agree that that's the reasonable accommodation. She is brought out of that. She complains to the HR department. And there again, we have the actual interactive process. And counsel ignores the fact that when Ms. Balatsoukas took her out of the huddle room, she said, we'll need additional medical documentation if you need additional accommodation.
Which she gets very promptly. It's March 3rd, I can see, that the Balatsoukas meeting takes place.
That's the meeting.
And she comes back with various suggestions from the doctor.
Not until April.
March 21st, she says the doctor's suggestion of a split schedule is unworkable. Maybe it is, I don't know, and there's some change. Then she contacts the complaint line at the end of March. In April, she gets a form from Dr. Gouray.
Correct. So the timeline, Your Honor, is...
But that's not the first form. He's filed several forms. He's filed several things.
This is the form that they provide to us in response to HR, where he offers the alternative accommodations. And again, it is critical to note, the very accommodation as an alternative he provides, which says, put her in the huddle room. They do. They do that very accommodation, exactly what the doctor said, put her in the huddle room. And so she is, as soon as they have that back provided to HR, they do that. And she is placed in there. Now, they do even more than that, Your Honor. Because not just do they put her back in the huddle room, but when her performance then fails to meet standards, the standard procedure would she would go to job in jeopardy status, which is a higher status, a more risky status. They don't put her in that status. They say, we'll give you additional time to meet that. The fact of the matter is, she did not ever meet that. And while she was able to meet it in less than 2 months, the first time she was in the huddle room, she did not ever meet it here. So they can't rely on some type of timing argument that we didn't give her enough time.
Why weren't you letting her work past 5:30 when
she
was on salary?
Her complaint was that I am fatigued at the office. I get fatigued and I can't sleep. The response to that was to say, we will allow you to come in later than the other employees.
That's not what I'm asking. I know you shifted her schedule by a half an hour. I'm asking, what was it to you if she thought she could pace herself during the day and maybe work until 6 or 6:30 or some other time? Why did you say she couldn't work past 5:30?
Because we did not want her to be overworking herself and becoming tired there. We did not ever impose any obligation on her or restrict her from working at home, which is what she had originally asked.
If she wants to work past 5:30, why do you forbid her? It's often more convenient to get your work done in the office as opposed to dragging a bunch of files home. And, I mean, you probably work both in an office and at home, too.
Your Honor, there is nothing in the record that says she asked to be able to stay late. The only reference in the record is a statement by Ms. Balatsoukas to Ms. Breckbuehl that said, try and make sure she goes home at 5:30. Now, counsel interprets that as saying, we're trying to restrict her. And that's not at all. The reasonable interpretation of that is, we want to make sure she's getting home, she's getting every opportunity to get her rest. If she wants to do work at home, she'd always been permitted to do work at home. We've never restricted her from doing it.
And what about this baseball thing? I mean, there was a comparator that she points to. Actually, there are two. There's the man who also is in these jeopardy positions. And then there's also this woman who works at home with her kid at baseball games.
There was a woman who was allowed to work at home during baseball games on a temporary basis. There's absolutely nothing
How
there.
Was she doing any work during her son's baseball game, if I might ask?
Well, she was home during the day to attend that. Now, I don't know any more details about that. I don't want to go too far with that, Your Honor.
No, it really seems to me if you're willing to let people work at home in some broader sense, then letting somebody work at home because their kid has an afternoon baseball game isn't quite as worthy a cause as accommodating a disability.
Well, it's important to note that here, that the conflict here, on the one hand, Ms. Mobley is saying, I need to stay at the office to get my work done. And on the other hand, she's arguing that somehow we restricted her, caused her harm, because we were going to allow her to go home if she wanted to do work at home. And we were encouraging
her. But you were not willing to allow her to actually work at home as a regular matter one day. She's exploring different possibilities. Her doctor says maybe this, maybe that, maybe the other thing. I'm not sure that there's anything inconsistent there.
And the burden is on the employee to show that the accommodation we provided was not reasonable. And in this case, we have the ultimate comparator in that that very accommodation worked before. And whether we thought it was temporary, whether it was an initial try, she got up to speed, she would say, arguably, it's not working when I go back to my cubicle. HR came in, got the documentation from the physician exactly as they should, and said, you're right, we're going to put you back in the huddle room exactly as your doctor requests. And that happened. And even when that happened, she was not able to meet the standards. And there's nothing to suggest that from the time we sent her back to the huddle room till the time she ended her employment that she asked for any other accommodation. And that's in Ms. Brenner's affidavit, that she was placed back in the huddle room, and at no point thereafter did she say, this is not sufficient accommodation, I need something more. And clearly, there is nothing in the record to suggest she ever, from that point forward, met the standards. So it is not Judge Barker's conclusion that it was temporary that is the focus of this case. We engaged in an interactive process. We put her in the very same accommodation, which counsel defines as reasonable and says it worked, and objectively, she didn't meet the standard, and she fell within the
reduction
force.
Okay, I'm going to just, before you sit down, I had one complaint, which is that a lot of your citations in your brief is to your reply brief in the other court. One has to go through kind of a multiple process to get back into the record if it's there at all, and that's not really what citations to the record means.
Noted, and we apologize for that, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. McLaughlin. Anything further, Mr. Betts?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the one key admission by counsel for Allstate Insurance is that they denied her what was a reasonable accommodation, and no explanation why they revoked it, other than we have a supervisor who is directly and blatantly antagonistic toward the whole spirit of the ADA, that when there's a accommodation that's reasonable, that's not causing any disruption or undue burden whatsoever, it's very simple, and it's working, it's improving the performance, Ms. Balasoukas jerks her out of it with no explanation to this very day, to this Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and then sticks her back into it after being commanded to do so by the HR director. And guess what happens? Within weeks, she's back on the RI status. That's the chronology of this. The closing argument would be that Ms. Balasoukas didn't like the ADA or accommodating Ms. Mobley, and so she manipulated the process. Any good employee would look at that and say, look, I had an accommodation that worked. My performance was improving. Let's not forget, for 14 years, I either met or exceeded expectations at this company, and I was a senior star performer in this company. Ms. Balasoukas expressed open antagonism toward this accommodation, jerked me out of it without explanation, then manipulated me back into this accommodation. And let's not also forget that her doctor recommended that she work only 4 days a week, because if there is this loving spirit that we hear evoked to the Seventh Circuit, the doctor, her own doctor, Gure, said let her work only 4 days. She would be more productive, a more efficient worker if you let her do that. Who denied that? Ms. Balasoukas denied that. That's in the appellate record, appendix 516, 316, and 501, that this was denied. What we have is a case that should go to a jury, and the The summary judgment was wrongly entered in this case. That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.